This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. When it comes to a trip to the beach, there are hazards you're aware of. Sunburn, getting caught in a rip current, stepping on a shell or a piece of glass, or in very rare cases, being bitten by a shark. But there's also hazards you may not consider, such as water quality. Fortunately, there's a team of about a dozen scientists with the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources that make sure your favorite swimming spot is safe. Manager of the Recreational Water Quality Program, J.D. Potts, says they've issued 14 swimming advisories so far this summer, one on Taylor Creek in Beaufort and at the Harkers Island Bridge.
Radio Island here in Beaufort-Moorhead area, we've had two advisories there this summer, and one time the advisory sign stayed up for 42 days. That's somewhat unusual. That's not always the case.
Two swimming advisories have been posted at the Newport River Access this summer. One lasted for a day, and the other advisory lasted 2 days. Another site at the mouth of Pantico Creek in Bellhaven isn't under an advisory right now, but earlier this summer, a sign was posted for 55 days. If contamination persists, county and state health directors have the authority to close a beach, but since the program started in 1997, that's never happened. Potts says there have been several locations along the North Carolina coast that have reoccurring issues every year.
The sites that we have problems with are the same sites that give us a problem year after year. We haven't posted any sites on the ocean so far this year. Last year we had a few, but most of these sites that give us the problems are Jockey's Ridge, Collington, which is near Jockey's Ridge State Park, and the Radio Island site.
Last year, Potts says they had an unusually high number of swimming advisories. On average, 30 to 35 advisories are issued annually, but in 2014, there were 55. If bacteria levels at a location pose a risk to humans, the State Department of Environment and Natural Resources will issue a swimming alert. This does not involve signage. If a resample at the site exceeds EPA standards, the alert becomes an advisory and a sign is posted at the beach. Potts says they test the water frequently in order to keep the public safe.
We monitor 204 swimming sites in the coastal area of North Carolina, and that's a mixture of ocean beaches, sounds, and coastal rivers, and we categorize those beaches based on usage. We have our ocean sites, which are considered Tier 1. Those are sites that are used daily, and we sample those sites weekly.
Potts says Tier 2 and Tier 3 sites are usually on the sound side and are monitored every other week.
When we're sampling, we wade out to about knee-deep, and we have a sampling stick that will extend out about 15 feet, and then we collect the sample about a foot deep, get them on ice. We have a holding time of 6 hours that the samples have to be back in the lab and then start the processing. And then 24 hours later, we have the results.
More than half of the sampling sites are ocean beaches, from Corralla to Sunset Beach. The remaining sites include the sounds and coastal rivers, like the Neuse and Pamlico. These areas are more prone to bacterial contamination because they're more susceptible to stormwater runoff.
It would mostly be fecal stores that are on the landscape and washing down into the water. So it could include wildlife, pet waste, or if you do have failing septic systems when it rains, that could wash off into the water and give us a bacteriological problem.
People who ignore an advisory and swim in a contaminated area can develop flu-like symptoms, gastroenteritis, stomach ache, and vomiting. Potts says children are at a higher risk because they tend to keep their heads underwater.
I have people that say that they've felt that they've become ill once they've learned that they were swimming in an area near a posted site, but I have not seen a doctor's report where anybody has gotten sick from swimming at one of our beaches.
There are some steps you can take to minimize your risk of being exposed to contaminated water. Potts suggests not swimming immediately after heavy rainfall, and he urges people to wash thoroughly after a trip to the beach. You can check the Department of Environment and Natural Resources website for current swimming advisories. We've provided a link at our website, publicradioeast.org. The North Carolina History Center in New Bern is hosting the exhibit, The Tuscarora World and New Bern in Maps. It's a new, free exhibit of 15 rare maps depicting the North Carolina coastal region and Tuscarora history from 1590 through 1800. This week, Lee Jenkins visited the History Center and has this audio tour of the exhibit.
I'm here today with Allison Rhodes Murphy, Director of Collections at the North Carolina History Center at Tryon Palace. Allison's going to be taking me on a tour of their new Tuscarora map exhibit. But before we begin, Allison, could you give me a little bit of background on the exhibit?
This is a traveling exhibit. It was created by Dr. Larry Tice of East Carolina University, and we're very excited to have it here as part of the homecoming, the Tuscarora homecoming that occurred last weekend.
And what can we learn from these maps?
The maps depict chronologically the coming of the English and what they found. We see their early images of what they believe they're going to find, what they do find, and then you can kind of see how the Tuscarora just kind of pushed out after a while.
Are these maps all from an exclusively European perspective, or did the Tuscarora make some maps themselves?
It's European.
Are these the original maps, or are they digital recreations or scans?
These are all digital reproductions. The originals are spread throughout the United States and Europe, and Dr. Tice spent about 10 years collecting these images, traveling, finding these images, digitizing them. So a lot of these have not been seen by the public. You could only see them at their home library. And so unless you were going to travel to Bern, you're not going to see some of these images.
Well, without further ado, let's begin the tour. So this is the oldest map in the collection, correct?
In this exhibit, yes. This is a 1590. It's a hand-colored engraving. And this one actually can be found at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
It definitely looks like a very stylized map. Was that just a quirk of the cartographer, or was that a very common way to make maps back then?
Yes, the colors, and yes, you can see there's a tree sitting right there in the middle of the landmass. So everything is definitely out of scale with the ships, and then of course you've got your lovely little sea monster down there to denote the sea. And you can see here, even back then, we joke that we were the graveyard of the Atlantic even then, because you've got ships sinking in the water.
I see this map has a signature by Christoph von Graffenried and what looks to be Newbern. What's going on right here?
He comes in, he's got a plan. He's ready to develop. And so he comes in and creates his own little outline of where his town is going and how it's going to be laid out, not really caring that there's already populations there. And we actually do have a close-up of the section of where Newbern is on the map that he created. This just goes to show that he's thinking it out, and this is what he's showing to his investors, that he has a plan, and it's buildings. He's actually growing buildings, but it's a little triangle plat.
Do you know what's going on in this picture right here? You mentioned earlier that its inclusion in the exhibit was controversial. Could you tell me more about that?
This is not necessarily a map. It's a sketch. This was when Lawson and de Graffenried were captured in 1711, and then Lawson was actually killed. And so de Graffenried is the one who actually wrote down the account of what happened, and he did his own depiction of what happened. There's lots of bad feelings about this within the Tuscarora Nation, obviously, with what happened to them and their homelands. But it's an important event that triggered everything that came after.
And now we come to this map, which looks a lot larger than any of the others we've seen, going all the way to Louisiana. What's going on here?
What's interesting about this is you're seeing larger scale development pushing in, explorers coming in, and they're trying to track where the different Indian tribes are and what's going on with conflicts.
And what we're looking at now is a close-up of that last map?
Yes, this is a detail from it. And it actually comments on the different conflicts and the different battles and things like that. So they actually talk about different land that was taken, different battles. In particular, they talk about one here with the Tuscarora.
So what is happening with the Tuscarora as they are depicted in this map?
It's just showing how the European settlers are just taking over the native population's lands and how they are being forced out. So this particular detail just shows what was happening in particular with the Tuscarora.
This is another large map, similar in size to the last one. What can we learn from this?
This one is a Moseley manuscript. It's 1737, and it's actually, his title on this page is, it's a developer's realm. Look at all this great land, come move here. It actually is notated on here that the Tuscarora are now removed from this particular area. This is a representation of an improvement made at the conflux of two rivers, which demonstrates the advantages of such a situation, both for profit, pleasure, and security. So again, they're trying to encourage investors, people come, people develop. We've moved the native populations out. We're open for business.
And on this map here, it looks like we have reservations. I guess this is where the Tuscarora went after they were pushed out.
Yeah, so this is the 1800 map. This is Morris Purchase. This is state of New York. The Tuscarora were actually the sixth nation in the Iroquois Confederation. So they moved north and joined up with the Iroquois. They had a reservation up in that area that they were pretty much forcibly moved to.
I believe that is the last of the maps. Well, thank you, Allison, for the wonderful tour. It's really interesting to see the history of the Tuscarora people following the arrival of the English play out like that over just a handful of maps. And what we've covered here today isn't even the entirety of the exhibit. There are still more maps on display. For more information about the exhibit, you can visit our ENC events page online at publicradioeast.org. I'm Lee Jenkins.
Coming up this Saturday, the Duke University Marine Lab in Beaufort is holding an open house event with lab demonstrations, tours, hands-on activities, and an art exhibit. Mac McKee speaks with program coordinator at the Duke Marine Lab, Sarah Phillips, about the free event.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on the Down East Journal.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Has the lab hosted many open houses in the past?
They have actually hosted open houses usually in the summertime. Summer is a good time because students are out of school and families are on vacation, and that's a great time for people to be able to come to the lab. It is a longstanding tradition for the lab to have events for the community, and I know this event specifically has been around now for about 10 to 12 years.
Now, there are many activities for the open house that look very family-friendly.
Yeah, so there's going to be a lot of different kind of stations around the entire Duke Marine Lab property. Everything from bioacoustic type events, so listening for whales, listening with laptops and headphones and listening to see if you can hear whales. We have an art gallery that a local artist will be here. And then we have a lot of things for younger students, a deep sea coloring table, four large computer monitors that are really focused on specimens of the deep sea. Then we have microscopes that are set up to look at little tiny animals that you would just find right here off our waters in North Carolina.
Now, Duke Marine Lab is going to great lengths to make oceanography and biology fun rather than intimidating. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me to see a young visitor go to the Duke Marine Lab this weekend and take their first step in a career of marine biology research.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's one thing that we're really trying to do is turn this into a little bit more of a hands-on type of world. A lot of people see on television or see on the internet all the different research in the marine biology world, but a lot of people, as I mentioned, people that live here in the area may not understand all of that research that's going on right here in their backyards. So we really do hope that a lot of students of all ages see kind of some of the things that we're doing and some of the research that our faculty are doing here as well.
What's the new Pilkey Research Lab like, and what kind of research is the lab used for?
So the Pilkey Research Lab is one of our brand new buildings. It was dedicated in 2014. It was named after Orrin Pilkey, who is a Duke Emeritus Professor of Geology. He's done a lot of work on beach kind of issues in ecology. There are people that are doing molecular research, larval ecology.
What are the dates and times of the open house?
So the open house is this Saturday, August the 1st. We are starting to do events, starting to open up the stations starting at 1 o'clock, and we will be doing those all the way through until 3 o'clock. So it's 1 to 3, and we really would love for people to get here, you know, earlier so those afternoon possible summer thunderstorms don't bother us.
Now, for all the visitors in the area, can you give us an idea of where the Duke Marine Lab is located, and is there any admission charge for the event?
Yeah, so there's no admission charge. The open house is free and open to the public. If you are in Beaufort, so the Duke Marine Lab shares Pivers Island with the NOAA facilities, and the turnoff to Pivers Island is right past the Beaufort drawbridge. So it's really close to downtown Beaufort, really easy to get to, right across from the bridge construction.
And for more information on the open house, you can visit the events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Sarah, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. We've had several weeks of very hot weather this summer, and when temperatures rise, we start to see some common problems, particularly in the vegetable garden. You may notice that your plants are producing lots of flowers, but little to no fruit is being set. And that means that there's little or nothing to harvest and enjoy in the kitchen. While this problem is most noticeable on tomatoes, it also affects peppers, beans, squash, and several other summer vegetables. What would cause summer vegetables to appear healthy but fail to produce? Well, there are several options, and shade or too much nitrogen could certainly do this, but in midsummer, the heat is often to blame. Research has shown that as daytime temperatures rise, particularly once they creep above 90 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, and nighttime temperatures rise above 70 to 75, that fruit set in many vegetables declines, and in some cases, it stops altogether. This is partly due to poor pollen or sterile pollen production. During high nighttime temperatures, plants aren't able to produce viable pollen, and this explains why we see these issues more in our coastal areas where the nights stay warm. These issues aren't as pronounced up in the mountains. Without viable pollen, plants can't set fruit, and so the flowers either abort or just drop off. Individual varieties respond to heat differently, so you may notice that one variety of tomatoes continues to set some fruit, while another one shuts down entirely. Fruits that do set often ripen very slowly. And this slow ripening is related to the second reason that plants may stop setting fruit during the hottest part of summer. And that second reason is water stress during the heat of the day. Plants need water to fill the cells of the fruit being produced. When daytime temperatures reach up into the 90s, many plants have trouble moving enough water into their leaves to keep them from drooping, even if there's adequate water in the soil. When plants can't keep their leaves full of water, they also don't have the water to spare for producing fruits, such as tomatoes, peppers, or beans. In addition, plants under water stress close the stomates, or the tiny pores in their leaves that allow gas exchange. Closing the stomates protects the plant from unrestricted water loss, but these stomates are also where carbon dioxide is exchanged with the atmosphere. This carbon dioxide is necessary for photosynthesis, so plants that are under water and heat stress have to make a choice. They either close their stomates to survive, but that means that they're just maintaining, rather than growing vigorously and ripening fruit. Fortunately, one day of these extreme temperatures is not enough to cause a stop in production. Instead, it's the accumulation of 5 to 7 days or more in a row that causes problems. And we've seen that several times this summer. There's little that gardeners can do to prevent low production during heat waves, except to keep their plants healthy during these extreme temperatures, so that when the temperatures cool down a little bit, production will start back up. In the meantime, I find the reasons behind that drop in production interesting to understand.
If you're looking for something to do this weekend, there's a local production of the Broadway hit Jesus Christ Superstar at the Masonic Theater in New Bern. Michael Peterson speaks with Rivertown Players director Siobhan Gastiel about the performance.
Jesus Christ Superstar presents the story of Jesus and his disciples from the time they enter into Jerusalem until Jesus' betrayal by Judas and his eventual crucifixion. Is this basically the same premise, or have you put a different spin on it?
Oh, no. I mean, we follow the music and the lyrics that Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice put together.
What do you think attracted Rivertown Players to choose this production out of the many choices that are brought to the board to choose from?
I've actually been trying to direct this show for about 4 years. It was on Broadway for a little while, so we couldn't get the rights. And then we kind of, you know, worked with the publishing company attempting to get the rights for a little while. So I've wanted to do it for a really long time. So I've been an advocate on the production board to make sure we got it done.
Tell me about the cast. How many people does it take usually to put on a production like this?
We have a cast of 35.
Wow.
So it's fairly large, and they are probably the most talented cast I've ever worked with. The lead characters are absolutely amazing.
How long have you been practicing this play?
We did our first round of auditions in April, and so we've been in rehearsals since about mid-May.
So this has been your whole summer.
It surely has, that and a baby.
Yeah, and congratulations again on that. Without giving too much away, what is your favorite moment in the show?
I have so many favorite moments. We have, you know, a lot of really powerful moments between Jesus and Judas. And then we have Herod, who comes on the stage and is just so much fun and lightens the mood. And so I can't really pick out one.
Has there been any particular difficult parts of the process of doing this play?
It's a challenging show. I mean, it's a rock opera, so there are no lines spoken whatsoever. It's only sung. And so we have to do a lot of vocal work.
In the show, who is your favorite character, and why do you think you identify with them?
Judas is my favorite character by far. One thing that I think is really interesting about the way that the story is told is the audience is able to relate with Judas and kind of understand where he's coming from and why he does what he does. So it kind of gives a different side than what we're presented, what we've learned as we've grown up and things like that. You get a different take on.
For the audience who sees the play, what message do you want them to walk away with?
So we just want to tell a really good story, and we want everyone to have a really good time. And we're not trying to make people think too hard, but I do think that people walk away. Some people get emotional when they watch the show, and others just walk away kind of singing the tune. So it kind of depends on what you're going in looking for.
Well, Siobhan, thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
The production of Jesus Christ Superstar is being performed at the Masonic Theater this Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m., and a matinee performance this Sunday at 3 p.m. and August 7th and 8th at 8 p.m. For more information, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Michael Peterson.
There is what we know. There is what we don't know. Then there's stuff we just can't mentally erase. Prepare yourself. Commentator Joan Karas runs down some science you just can't forget.
Now that the internet has supplanted encyclopedias, we can absorb new knowledge the way a whale eats krill, in voluminous gulps. Today you can locate online any business impossible to find in your phone directory. Medical conditions that you heard about only 5 minutes ago have multiple websites. Before browsing, however, I'd suggest a double shot of bourbon. For sure there are things we wish we did not know. In particular, I know that most foods have way too many calories. Is it fair for a piece of cherry pie to have 320 calories? Cherries are fruit for Pete's sake, and fruit is a dietary staple. A small Carr's water cracker with guacamole is 120 calories in one bite. Worst of all is chocolate, which comes from the cacao bean, as we all know. Beans are vegetables. Another dietary staple. But going from bean to one Ghirardelli chocolate square somehow adds 220 calories. A few scientists should stop studying the water flea and turn their attention to this more pressing issue. Next, I have learned that computers are not going to go away. For years, I have cursed them, encouraged other writers to keep their typewriters in peak condition, and prayed to the gods in all religions. To no avail. I must bow to the pushy, intrusive e-revolution. The very least computer programmers could do is to realize that real people out here want machines that do simple things simply. Stop trying to be clever. On another note, let's consider pillows. You probably have a favorite pillow, and like mine, it may be over 5 years old. Science tells us that this cherished pillow is stuffed with thousands of microscopic dust mites. They live on the dead skin that we slough off, and on average, each dust mite poops 20 times a day in your pillow. So, perhaps it's time for more bourbon, but for sure it is time for a new favorite pillow. Still considering scientific facts, here's a report from the Washington Post. In a belly button diversity project that took place at NC State, scientists analyzed 95 separate navel samplings that revealed 1,400 different bacterial strains, some so new they couldn't be classified. I quote, "The human navel should be designated as a bacterial nature reserve." A bacterial nature reserve. It's doubtful that all 1,400 of these bacteria live in your personal belly button, of course. But you have at least a sizable village in there. What do you suppose they do all day? Well, maybe we don't really want to know. On a more visual level are bedbugs, found in nearly every bed in medieval days. They're much less prevalent now, but still active. A brand new title by Brooke Borrell, Infested, is touted as The Biological and Cultural History of Bedbugs. Who knew that bedbugs had their own culture? Science never sleeps.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press.